The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. On January 20th, Joseph Biden was inaugurated as the 46th President of the United States. Today, I will interweave stories from the New Yorker about the inauguration with readings of North Carolina's Bishop William Barber's homily for the National Inaugural Prayer Service, Amanda Gorman's inaugural poem, and Langston Hughes' poem, Let America Be America. And now, from the daily comment section of the web version of the New Yorker magazine, January 21st, 2021, A Broken Land, Biden and the True Costs of Unity, by Evan Osnos. The inauguration of Joe Biden as the 46th president was the culmination of stories long and short. 60 years ago, the success of a fellow Irish Catholic, John F. Kennedy, inspired a teenage admirer in Delaware to study the Congressional Directory in the school library for clues into how he might achieve the ludicrous ambition to follow him. His conclusion? Law school. 4 years ago, the arrival of Donald Trump launched a cascading catastrophe of such lethal effect that he was driven from office after the death of as many Americans from a pandemic as died in the Second World War. And just 2 weeks ago, a mob of Trump followers, intoxicated by lies and rage, seized the Capitol in service of a delusion that they might overturn the election results. In his inaugural address, Biden spoke less of triumph than of warning. We've learned again that democracy is precious. Democracy is fragile. At this hour, my friends, democracy has prevailed. At this hour, it was an acknowledgement of the risk that remain in what he called a winter of peril and significant possibilities, much to repair, much to restore, much to heal, much to build, and much to gain. He dispensed with the euphemisms to speak plainly of the crises before him, white supremacy, domestic terrorism, and a cry for survival from the planet itself. He invoked St. Augustine's definition of a people as a multitude defined by the common objects of their love. It was an elegant object of aspiration, even if it carried the faint echo of Abraham Lincoln's 1861 inaugural address, in which he appealed to Americans' bonds of affection and their mystic cords of memory. An address followed 6 weeks later by war. It was a relevant analogy. Biden turned over and over again to the prospects for national reunion, what he called the way of unity. We can see each other not as adversaries, but as neighbors. We can treat each other with dignity and respect. We can join forces, stop the shouting, and lower the temperature. For without unity, there is no peace, only bitterness and fury. No progress, only exhausting outrage. No nation, only a state of chaos. Biden told the story of how, in 1863, Lincoln dedicated what he called his whole soul to the spirit of the Emancipation Proclamation. When he put pen to paper, the president said, and I quote, "If my name ever goes down into history, it'll be for this act," Biden said. And in that spirit, he added, "On this January day, my whole soul is in this, bringing America together, uniting our people, uniting our nation. And I ask every American to join me in this cause." In launching his presidency around the pursuit of unity, Biden will immediately face the hard political calculations of making it concrete. And therein lies a challenge worthy of his whole soul. Last spring, when Biden was still deep in the competition for the presidency, he sought out the advice of the Reverend Dr. William Barber, a pastor of the Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro, North Carolina, an icon in the present struggle for civil rights, an activist whom Jelani Cobb has called the individual most capable of crafting a broad-based political counterpoint to the divisiveness of Trumpism. Barber is a fellow traveler on the path of unity, but he is vigilant against the trade-offs that might occur in the pursuit. When they spoke, Barber recalled he told Biden, "Our Constitution does not start with ensuring tranquility. It starts with establishing justice." In a call this week, Barber told me, "In my tradition, hope is different than optimism. Hope has to deal with what caused despair. Trump may have lit some matches in this idea of dividing the country, but Trump inherited an audience that had been prepped and primed for years." In Barber's view, the sources of disunity are not simply incivility or rhetorical excess. They are the underlying facts of injustice, dispossession, and immiseration. I said, even before COVID, 43% of this country is poor and low wealth. People are mourning because they don't have health care, wages, and sick leave. They're mourning because of the racism. Since 2017, Barber has co-chaired the Poor People's Campaign, which takes its name from Martin Luther King Jr.'s 1968 call for a revolution of values in America. The campaign seeks to unite poor and impacted communities across the country, including communities of color and, in many cases, poor white people, in a shared pursuit of higher wages, a single-payer health care system, and voting rights protection. Barber told me, in Georgia, for instance, 45%, not of black people, of all people, are poor or low wealth. 1.9 million people in Georgia make less than a living wage. 1.4 million people in Georgia are without health care. A third of all poverty is in the South. A third of all white poverty is in the South. Speak to that in your policies. In their call last spring and in contacts since then, Barber has urged Biden and his advisors to prepare for political fights in the short term over wages, health care, racism, and other divisive issues in our politics, in pursuit of a larger, more sustainable unity. It's got to be not just rhetoric and on the surface, Barber told me. You have to go down to the real level of people's pain and what folks are experiencing in the country, he said. On the morning after the inauguration, Barber gave the homily at the official inaugural prayer service at the Washington National Cathedral. He addressed a new country, a new president, and a country still dawning to the idea of rediscovering what Biden, in his inaugural address, called America's common objects: opportunity, security, liberty, dignity, respect, honor, and yes, the truth. Biden, like Barber, signaled his wariness of glib pronouncements. "I know speaking of unity can sound to some like a foolish fantasy," the new president told the nation. "I know the forces that divide us are deep and they are real, but I also know that they are not new. Our history has been a constant struggle between the American ideal that we're all created equal and the harsh, ugly reality that racism, nativism, fear, demonization have long torn us apart. The battle is perennial. Victory is never assured. For Biden, that battle has been a long time coming, and now he has joined it." And now, the homily at the National Inaugural Prayer Service for President Joseph R. Biden and Vice President Kamala D. Harris, January 21st, 2021. "Repairing, rebuilding, renewing, and revival can be real if," by Bishop William J. Barber a second. Our text this morning comes from the prophet Isaiah, chapter 58. It begins, "This is the kind of fast day I'm after, to break the chains of injustice, get rid of exploitation in the workplace, free the oppressed, cancel debts. What I'm interested in seeing you do is sharing your food with the hungry, inviting the homeless poor into your homes, putting clothes on the shivering, ill-clad." And it ends saying, "If you get rid of unfair practices, quit blaming victims, quit gossiping about other people's sins, if you are generous with the hungry and start giving yourselves to the down and out, your lives will begin to glow in the darkness. You'll use the old rubble of past lives to build anew, rebuild the foundations from out of your past. You'll be known as those who can fix anything, restore old ruins, rebuild and renovate, make the community livable again." The text this morning is from the prophet Isaiah, but the prophet, being able to see the future, may have taken his text from the old Chitlin' Circuit comic Moms Mabley, who used to tell what one strawberry said to the other. Strawberry: "If we hadn't been in that bed together, we wouldn't be in this jam today." Well, we are in a jam today. Trouble is real, and whether we like it or not, we are in this mess together as a nation. When this word of the Lord came to Isaiah, his people were also in a jam. Bad leadership, greed, and injustice and lies had led them into trouble, exile, and economic hardship. In that day, some tried to simply cover up the trouble with false religion and deceit. But God said to the prophet, "Sound the trumpet, tell the nation of its sin. Tell them that just going through the motions of prayer will not get them out of this jam. I need them to repent of what got them here and turn in a new direction." The prophet was saying what Jesus would say about nations caring for the least of these. The prophet was saying then what Franklin Delano Roosevelt said in the 1930s to an America with one-third of the nation ill-housed, ill-clad, and ill-nourished, besieged by the Great Depression, and beset by bigotry and hatred. At such a time as this, FDR said, "The rest of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much, it is whether we provide enough for those who have too little." Isaiah was saying what Dr. King said to America when we faced a jam in the 1960s. "The time has come for an all-out world war against poverty. The rich nations must use their vast resources of wealth to develop the underdeveloped, school the unschooled, feed the unfed. Ultimately, a great nation is a compassionate nation." The prophet's basic question to the leadership of his day was the question the economist Joseph Stiglitz has asked. Not how much will it cost the government to address inequality, but how much has it cost us not to? It is the truth Aretha Franklin pointed to when she sang, "Holy, holy, come together. We have got to come together. We can rock this earth's foundation, holler love across the nation. We proclaim love our salvation. Yes, we can." And so the prophet gives the nation God's clear guidance out of the jam it is in. Choose first to repent of the policy sin. Then, repair the breach. The breach, according to the imagery of Isaiah, is when there is a gap in the nation between what is and how God wants things to be. Transposed to our time, the breach is when we say, "One nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all," with our lips, while we see the rich and the poor living in two very different Americas. The breach would be knowing the only way to ensure domestic tranquility is to establish justice. But pretending we can address the nation's wounds with simplistic calls for unity. The breach is telling lies when we need truth. Greed when we need compassion. Fighting one another when we need to find common ground. And hating when we ought to be loving. And every now and then, a nation needs breach repairers to take us forward. Mr. President, you have known the breach of economic struggle in your childhood and the breach of a broken heart. Madam Vice President, you have known the political and social breach caused by racism that tried to place a breach between the intelligence you had and the school you could attend. Your mother fought and organized because she knew this nation's breach. And both of you know that the only way forward is for breaches to be repaired. This moment in our nation is not about left, right, or centrist. It should not be about Republicans and Democrats. Even what we saw at the Capitol 2 weeks ago is the result of a long history, a politics of division that was cynically named positive polarization by those who thought they could use it for their own political advantage. This strategy of feeding and seeding intentional racial and class divisions into the body politic spilled over into the inevitable violence that ideas of supremacy always produce. If we want to come out of this jam and move forward together, we cannot accept the racial disparities, violence, and breaches that impact Black, Brown, Native, and Asian Americans, while offering collateral damage to our poor white brothers and sisters, and ultimately our entire democracy. We can't accept the poverty and low wealth of 140 million Americans before COVID, and many more millions since. We must have a third reconstruction. We must address the five interlocking injustices of systemic racism, poverty, ecological devastation, denial of health care, the war economy, and the false moral narrative of religious nationalism. These are breaches that must be addressed. And according to the text, repairing the breaches will bring revival. If you get rid of unfair practices, the prophet says, if you are generous with the hungry and start giving yourselves to the down and out, then you'll be known as repairers of the breach, those who can fix anything, restore old ruins, rebuild and renovate, make the community livable again. There is hope in the morning. M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. Jürgen Moltmann once said, faith, wherever it develops into hope, causes not rest, but unrest, not patience, but impatience. Those who hope in God can no longer put up with reality as it is, but begin to suffer under it, to contradict it. We don't have to put up with things as they are. We can contradict the breach with every prayer, every policy, every sermon from every pulpit, and every call to the people. If we, the people, with God's help, repair the breach, revival and renewal will come. Weeping and mourning may endure in this night of our discontent, but joy will come in the morning. Love and light will burst through. God will hear our prayers if we do the work of repairing society's breach. No, America has never yet been all that she has hoped to be. But right here, right now, a third reconstruction is possible if we choose. So let us ask God again what that great preacher and hymn writer Harry Emerson Fosdick asked in the midst of the Great Depression, when the nation was in a jam and needed some breach repairers. He wrote and sang and prayed, God of grace and God of glory, on thy people pour thy power. Cure thy children's warring madness. Bend our pride to thy control. Shame our wanton selfish gladness, rich in things and poor in soul. Save us from weak resignation to the evils we deplore. Let the search for thy salvation be our glory evermore. O God, grant us wisdom, grant us courage for the facing of this hour. For the facing of this hour. Yes, God, grant us wisdom and grant us courage until thoughts of destroying one another give way to deeds of embracing each other. Until our policies prove our promise of equal justice under law. Until we decide too many have been hurting too long. Grant us courage until in every way we show in our democratic process that everybody has a right to live. Until we lift from the bottom so that everybody rises. Until the stones that the builder rejected become the chief cornerstone of a new social reality. Please, God, grant us wisdom, grant us courage until the poor are lifted, the sick are healed, children are protected, and civil rights and human rights never neglected. Grant us wisdom for the facing of this hour until love and justice are never rejected. Grant us wisdom and courage for the facing of this hour until together we make sure that there is racial justice and economic justice and living wage justice and health care justice and ecological justice and disability justice and justice for homeless and justice for the poor and low wealth and working poor and immigrant justice until we study war no more and peace and justice are the way we live. This is the only path to domestic tranquility and healing. So, God, grant us as a people, grant us as an entire nation, grant our new president, grant our new vice president, grant every preacher, grant every politician, grant every person, black and white, Latino, Native, Asian, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, Hindu, people of faith, not of faith, but with a moral conscience, every human being created by God, documented or undocumented, gay, straight, or trans, young or old. And what a day it will be when our children's children call us what you have called us to be, repairers of the breach. Amen. Next, the inaugural poem for the inauguration of the 46th President of the United States, Joseph R. Biden. The Hill We Climb by Amanda Gorman. When day comes, we ask ourselves, where can we find light in this never-ending shade? The loss we carry, a sea we must wade. We've braved the belly of the beast. We've learned that quiet isn't always peace. And the norms and notions of what just is isn't always justice. And yet the dawn is ours before we knew it. Somehow we do it. Somehow we've weathered and witnessed a nation that isn't broken, but simply unfinished. We, the successors of a country and a time, where a skinny black girl, descended from slaves and raised by a single mother, can dream of becoming president, only to find herself reciting for one. And yes, we are far from polished, far from pristine. But that doesn't mean we are striving to form a union that is perfect. We are striving to forge a union with purpose, to compose a country committed to all cultures, all colors, all characters and conditions of man. And so, we lift our gazes not to what stands between us, but what stands before us. We close the divide because we know to put our future first, we must first put our differences aside. We lay down our arms so we can reach out our arms to one another. We seek harm to none and harmony for all. Let the globe, if nothing else, say this is true. That even as we grieved, we grew. That even as we hurt, we hoped. That even as we tired, we tried. That we'll forever be tied together, victorious. Not because we will never again know defeat, but because we will never again sow division. Scripture tells us to envision that everyone shall sit under their own vine and fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. If we're to live up to our own time, then victory won't lie in the blade, but in all the bridges we've made. That is the promise to glade the hill we climb. If only we dare. It's because being American is more than a pride we inherit. It's the past we step into and how we repair it. We've seen a force that would shatter our nation rather than share it. Would destroy our country if it meant delaying democracy. And this effort very nearly succeeded. But while democracy can be periodically delayed, it can never be permanently defeated. In this truth, in this faith we trust. For while we have our eyes on the future, history has its eyes on us. This is the era of just redemption. We feared at its inception. We did not feel prepared to be the heirs of such a terrifying hour. But within it we found the power to author a new chapter, to offer hope and laughter to ourselves. So while once we asked, how could we possibly prevail over catastrophe? Now we assert, how could catastrophe possibly prevail over us? We will not march back to what was, but move to what shall be. A country that is bruised but whole, benevolent but bold, fierce and free. We will not be turned around or interrupted by intimidation, because we know our inaction and inertia will be the inheritance of the next generation. Our blunders become their burdens. But one thing is certain. If we merge mercy with might and might with right, then love becomes our legacy and change our children's birthright. So let us leave behind a country better than the one we were left with. Every breath from my bronze-pounded chest, we will raise this wounded world into a wondrous one. We will rise from the gold-limbed hills of the West. We will rise from the wind-swept Northeast where our forefathers first realized revolution. We will rise from the lake-rimmed cities of the Midwestern states. We will rise from the sun-baked South. We will rebuild, reconcile, and recover. And every known nook of our nation and every corner called our country, our people diverse and beautiful, will emerge, battered and beautiful. When day comes, we step out of the shade, aflame and unafraid. The new dawn blooms as we free it, for there is always light, if only we're brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it. And now, from the online edition of the New Yorker magazine, January 21st, 2021, Amanda Gorman's inaugural poem is A Stunning Vision of Democracy by Masha Gessen. Among the first in Amanda Gorman's inaugural poem, The Hill We Climb, is the concept of democracy that it assumed. Democracy, according to the 22-year-old poet, is an aspiration, a thing of the future. The word democracy first appears in the same verse in which Gorman refers to a force that would shatter our nation rather than share it. The insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th took place while Gorman was working on the poem. Although the force, one may assume, is bigger than the insurrection, It is the Trump presidency that made the insurrection possible and the forces of white supremacy and inequality that enabled that president. It would destroy our country if it meant delaying democracy. And this effort very nearly succeeded, the poem continues. But while democracy can be periodically delayed, it can never be permanently defeated. Both times that the poem raises democracy, Gorman pairs the word with delay, which tells us that democracy is a thing expected, anticipated, not a thing that we have built or possessed, but a dream. This is not the way that politicians or even political theorists usually use the word democracy, but it is one way that philosophers have used it. Jacques Derrida, the French deconstructionist, used the term democracy to come. Democracy, he wrote, was always forged and threatened by contradictory forces, and thus is always deferred, always out of reach, even in societies that adopt democracy as their governing principle. Gorman's poem is explicitly a text about the future. She exhorts Americans to look not at what stands between us, but what stands before us. She says at the beginning that we know to put our future first, and she ends with a verse of promises and challenges as rousing as any ever written. The focus on the future is a direct response to the rhetoric of the outgoing president, who called on his mob to transport the country back to an imaginary past and forced Americans to live in a present without end. To write about the future, Gorman has also to write about the past. Being American is more than a pride we inherit. It's the past we step into it and how we repair it, she says, in an elegant rebuke to the rhetoric of return to normalcy. We will not march back to what was, but move to what shall be. Again, she stresses that the promise of American democracy is still there, still yet to arrive. In everyday speech, Americans usually refer to democracy as a thing that we have, or used to have, before Trump came along. In the tradition of American political speeches, democracy often figures as a work in progress. This, too, suggests that democracy is something we inhabit but continue to work on, an endless fixer-upper with good bones. Gorman's explicit assumption is more radical and challenging. It's not only philosophy where the idea of a democracy to come can be found. The hill we climb evokes another great American poet, Langston Hughes. Let America be America again. Hughes wrote, "America never was America to me, and yet I swear this oath, America will be." An immortal distillation of the tension between American aspirations and American reality, and a stubborn insistence that the country continue to reach for its dream. There is no better place to start for an inaugural poem or for a presidency. Next, the poem mentioned in the previous article, Let America Be America Again, by Langston Hughes. Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain, seeking a home where he himself is free. America never was America to me. Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. Let it be that great, strong land of love, where never kings connive nor tyrants scheme, that any man be crushed by one above. It never was America to me. Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath, but opportunity is real, and life is free. Equality is in the air we breathe. There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this homeland of the free. Say, who are you that mumbles in the dark? And who are you that draws your veil across the stars? I am the poor white, fooled and pushed apart. I am the Negro, bearing slavery's scars. I am the red man driven from the land. I am the immigrant clutching the hope I seek, and finding only the same old stupid plan of dog-eat-dog, of mighty-crush-the-weak. I am the young man, full of strength and hope, tangled in that ancient endless chain of profit, power, gain, of grab the land, of grab the gold, of grab the ways of satisfying need, of work the men, of take the pay, of owning everything for one's own greed. I am the farmer, bondsman to the soil. I am the worker sold to the machine. I am the Negro, servant to you all. I am the people, humble, hungry, mean, hungry yet today, despite the dream. Beaten yet today, O pioneers, I am the man who never got ahead, the poorest worker bartered through the years. Yet I'm the one who dreamt our basic dream. In the old world, while still a serf of kings, who dreamt a dream so strong, so brave, so true, that even yet its mighty daring sings in every brick and stone, in every furrow turned, that's made America the land it has become. Oh, I'm the man who sailed those early seas in search of what I meant to be my home. For I'm the one who left dark Ireland's shore, and Poland's plain, and England's grassy lay, and torn from black Africa's strand I came, to build a homeland of the free. The free? Who said the free? Not me. Surely not me. The millions on relief today? The millions shot down when we strike? The millions who have nothing for our pay? For all the dreams we've dreamed, and all the songs we've sung, and all the hopes we've held, and all the flags we've hung, the millions who have nothing for our pay, except the dream that's almost dead today. Oh, let America be America again, the land that never has been yet, and yet must be, the land where every man is free, the land that's mine, the poor man's, Indians, Negroes, me, who made America, whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain, whose hand at the foundry, whose plow in the rain, must bring back our mighty dream again. Sure, call me any ugly name you choose. The steel of freedom does not stain. From those who live like leeches on the people's lives, we must take back our land again. America. Oh, yes, I say it plain. America never was America to me. And yet I swear this oath, America will be. Out of the rack and ruin of our gangster death, the rape and rot of graft and stealth and lies, we the people must redeem the land, the mines, the plants, the rivers, the mountains and the endless plain, all the stretch of these great green states, and make America again. Next, I will read excerpts from remarks by President Barack Obama in elegy for the Honorable Reverend Clementa Pinckney on June 26, 2015. In Charleston, South Carolina. The Bible calls us to hope, to persevere and have faith in things not seen. They were still living by faith when they died, Scripture tells us. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on earth. We are here today to remember a man of God who lived by faith, a man who believed in things not seen, a man who believed there were better days ahead, off in the distance, a man of service who persevered, knowing full well he would not receive all those things he was promised, because he believed his efforts would deliver a better life for those who followed. Friends of his remarked this week that when Clementa Pinckney entered a room, it was like the future arrived, that even from a young age, folks knew he was special, anointed. He was in the pulpit by 13, pastor by 18, public servant by 23. He did not exhibit any of the cockiness of youth, nor youth's insecurities. Instead, he set an example worthy of his position, wise beyond his years, in his speech, in his conduct, in his love, faith, and purity. As a senator, he represented a sprawling swath of the Lowcountry, a place that has long been one of the most neglected in America. Reverend Pinckney embodied a politics that was neither mean nor small. He conducted himself quietly and kindly and diligently. He encouraged progress not by pushing his ideas alone, but by seeking out your ideas, partnering with you to make things happen. He was full of empathy and fellow feeling, able to walk in somebody else's shoes and see through their eyes. He embodied the idea that our Christian faith demands deeds and not just words, that the sweet hour of prayer actually lasts the whole week long, that to put our faith in action is more than individual salvation. It's about our collective salvation. That to feed the hungry and clothe the naked and house the homeless is not just a call for isolated charity, but the imperative of a just society. What a good man. Sometimes I think that's the best thing to hope for when you're eulogized. After all the words and recitations and resumes are read, to just say someone was a good man. What a life Clementa Pinckney lived. What an example he set. What a model for his faith. And then to lose him at 41, slain in his sanctuary with 8 wonderful members of his flock, each at different stages in life, but bound together by a common commitment to God. To the families of the fallen, the nation shares in your grief. Our pain cuts that much deeper because it happened in a church. The church is and always has been the center of African-American life, a place to call our own in a too often hostile world, a sanctuary from so many hardships. That's what the black church means, our beating heart, the place where our dignity as a people is inviolate. There's no better example of this tradition than Mother Emanuel. A church built by blacks seeking liberty, burned to the ground because its founder sought to end slavery, only to rise up again, a phoenix from these ashes. We do not know whether the killer of Reverend Pinckney and 8 others knew all of this history, but he surely sensed the meaning of his violent act. It was an act that drew on a long history of bombs and arson, and shots fired at churches, not random, but as a means of control, a way to terrorize and oppress. An act that he imagined would incite fear and recrimination, violence and suspicion. An act that he presumed would deepen divisions that trace back to our nation's original sin. Oh, but God works in mysterious ways. God has different ideas. He didn't know he was being used by God. Blinded by hatred, the alleged killer could not see the grace surrounding Reverend Pinckney and that Bible study group, the light of love that shone as they opened the church doors and invited a stranger to join in their prayer circle. The alleged killer could have never anticipated the way the families of the fallen would respond when they saw him in court. In the midst of unspeakable grief, with words of forgiveness. He couldn't imagine that. The alleged killer could not imagine how the city of Charleston, under the good and wise leadership of Mayor Riley, how the state of South Carolina, how the United States of America would respond. Not merely with revulsion at his evil act, but with big-hearted generosity, and more importantly, with a thoughtful introspection and self-examination that we so rarely see in public life. The alleged killer could not imagine how the city of Charleston, under the good, wise leadership of Mayor Riley, how the state of South Carolina, how the United States of America would respond. Blinded by hatred, he failed to comprehend what Reverend Pinckney so well understood, the power of God's grace. This whole week, I've been reflecting on this idea of grace. The grace of the families who lost loved ones. The grace that Reverend Pinckney would preach about in his sermons. The grace described in one of my favorite hymnals, the one we all know. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. According to the Christian tradition, grace is not earned. Grace is not merited. It's not something we deserve. Rather, grace is the free and benevolent favor of God, as manifested in the salvation of sinners and the bestowal of blessings. Grace. As a nation, out of this terrible tragedy, God has visited grace upon us. For he has allowed us to see where we've been blind. He has given us the chance where we've been lost to find our best selves. We may not have earned it, this grace, with our rancor and complacency and short-sightedness and fear of each other. But we got it all the same. He gave it to us anyway. He's once more given us grace. But it is up to us now to make the most of it, to receive it with gratitude, and to prove ourselves worthy of this gift. For too long, we were blind to the pain that the Confederate flag stirred in too many of our citizens. It's true, a flag did not cause these murders. But as people from all walks of life, Republicans and Democrats, now acknowledge, including Governor Haley, whose recent eloquence on the subject is worthy of praise, as we all have to acknowledge, the flag has always represented more than just ancestral pride. For many, black and white, that flag was a reminder of systemic oppression and racial subjugation. We see that now. Removing the flag from this state's capital would not be an act of political correctness. It would not be an insult to the valor of Confederate soldiers. It would simply be an acknowledgement that the cause for which they fought, the cause of slavery, was wrong. The imposition of Jim Crow after the Civil War, the resistance to civil rights for all people, was wrong. It would be one step in an honest accounting of America's history, a modest but meaningful balm for so many unhealed wounds. It would be an expression of the amazing changes that have transformed this state and this country for the better because of the work of so many people of goodwill, people of all races striving to form a more perfect union. By taking down that flag, we express God's grace. But I don't think God wants us to stop there. For too long, we've been blind to the way past injustices continue to shape the present. Perhaps we see that now. Perhaps this tragedy causes us to ask some tough questions about how we can permit so many of our children to languish in poverty, or attend dilapidated schools, or grow up without prospects for a job or for a career. Perhaps it causes us to examine what we're doing to cause some of our children to hate. Perhaps it softens hearts toward those lost young men, tens and tens of thousands caught up in the criminal justice system, and leads us to make sure that the system is not infected with bias, that we embrace changes in how we train and equip our police, so that the bonds of trust between law enforcement and the communities they serve make us all safer and more secure. Maybe we now realize the way racial bias can infect us even when we don't realize it, so that we're guarding against not just racial slurs, but we're also guarding against the subtle impulse to call Johnny back for a job interview, but not Jamal. So that we search our hearts when we consider laws to make it harder for some of our fellow citizens to vote. By recognizing our common humanity, by treating every child as important, regardless of the color of their skin or the station into which they were born, and to do what's necessary to make opportunity real for every American. By doing that, we express God's grace. None of us can or should expect a transformation in race relations overnight. Every time something like this happens, somebody says we have to have a conversation about race. We talk a lot about race. There's no shortcut, and we don't need more talk. None of us should believe that a handful of gun safety measures will prevent every tragedy. It will not. People of goodwill will continue to debate the merits of various policies as our democracy requires. This is a big, raucous place America is. And there are good people on both sides of these debates. Whatever solutions we find will necessarily be incomplete. But it would be a betrayal of everything Reverend Pinckney stood for, I believe, if we allowed ourselves to slip into a comfortable silence again. Once the eulogies have been delivered, once the TV cameras move on, to go back to business as usual. That's what we so often do to avoid uncomfortable truths about the prejudice that still infects our society. To settle for symbolic gestures without following up with the hard work of more lasting change, that's how we lose our way again. It would be a refutation of the forgiveness expressed by those families if we merely slipped into old habits, whereby those who disagree with us are not merely wrong, but bad. Where we shout instead of listen, where we barricade ourselves behind preconceived notions or well-practiced cynicism. Reverend Pinckney once said, "Across the South, we have a deep appreciation of history. We haven't always had a deep appreciation of each other's history." What is true in the South is true for America. Clem understood that justice grows out of recognition of ourselves in each other. That my liberty depends on you being free, too. That history can't be a sword to justify injustice or a shield against progress, but must be a manual for how to avoid repeating the mistakes of the past. How to break the cycle. A roadway toward a better world. He knew that that path of grace involves an open mind, but more importantly, an open heart. That's what I felt this week, an open heart, that more than any particular policy or analysis is what's called upon right now, I think. What a friend of mine, the writer Marilyn Robinson, calls that reservoir of goodness beyond and of another kind that we are able to do each other in the ordinary cause of things. That reservoir of goodness, if we can find that grace, anything is possible. If we can tap that grace, everything can change. Amazing grace. Amazing grace. And now, Democracy by Leonard Cohen, published in 1992. I'm sentimental, if you know what I mean. I love the country, but I can't stand the scene. And I'm neither left or right. I'm just staying home tonight, getting lost in that hopeless little screen. But I'm stubborn as those garbage bags that time cannot decay. I'm junk, but I'm still holding up this little wild bouquet. Democracy is coming to the USA. It's coming through a hole in the air from those nights in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the wars against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA. It's coming through a crack in the wall on a visionary flood of alcohol, from the staggering account of the Sermon on the Mount, which I don't pretend to understand at all. It's coming from the silence on the dock of the bay, from the brave, the bold, the battered heart of Chevrolet. Democracy is coming to the USA. It's coming from the sorrow in the street, the holy places where the races meet. From the homicidal bitchin' that goes down in every kitchen to determine who will serve and who will eat. From the wells of disappointment where the women kneel to pray for the grace of God in the desert here and the desert far away. Democracy is coming to the USA. Sail on, O mighty ship of state, to the shores of need. Past the reefs of greed, through the squalls of hate, sail on, sail on. It's coming to America first, the cradle of the best and of the worst. It's here they got the range and the machinery for change. And it's here they got the spiritual thirst. It's here the family's broken, and it's here the lonely say that the heart has got to open in a fundamental way. Democracy is coming to the USA. I'm sentimental, if you know what I mean. I love the country, but I can't stand the scene. I'm neither left or right. I'm just staying home tonight, getting lost in that hopeless little screen. But I'm stubborn as those garbage bags that time cannot decay. I'm junk, but I'm still holding up this little wild bouquet. Democracy is coming to the USA. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.